Hello, and welcome to Season 7, Episode 7 of the Virtual Coffee Podcast. I'm Becca, and this is a podcast that features members of the Virtual Coffee community. Virtual Coffee is an intimate group of developers at all stages of their coding journey, and they're here on this podcast sharing their stories and what they've learned. Here with me today is my co-host, Dan.
What up, Beck? How's it going?
Hey, fantastic. Hey.
Great. I'm glad to hear it. It is going well over here, too. Not that you asked, but, you know.
You didn't even give me an opportunity to ask, okay? So, next time.
Next time. Okay, sure. Well, anyway, we have an awesome guest for you all today, Dominic Duffin. He has been a longtime Virtual Coffee member and big contributor to a lot of our things that we have going on throughout the year. And Dominic is, well, he's a full stack developer. He's co-founder of the Art Tech Chat, Twitter chat that you might have seen, which is really cool. And it's open source contributor. And well, and on his bio, he says aspiring polymath, which is really cool. And I think he talks about being a polymath or aspiring to be a polymath in the podcast episode. So you get to hear all about what that actually means if you don't know.
Yeah. And we talked about different ways of learning, non-traditional learning methods, the importance of community and how that helps you to be a better learner and to grow and to have the support of other people as you do all those things. So it was really great to have that conversation with Dominic and learn about his experience.
Yeah, totally. I found it very interesting. Dominic was homeschooled and has a lot of positive and strong feelings about that experience. And I found it very, very interesting and rewarding to talk to him about it, see things from his perspective. It was really cool.
Yep. And no more spoilers. So we start every episode of the podcast like we start every Virtual Coffee. We introduce ourselves with our name, where we're from, what we do, and a random check-in question. We hope you enjoy this episode. Today's random check-in question is, what is your favorite way to eat a potato? My name is Becca. I am a neurobiologist from a small town in Ohio. And my favorite way to eat a potato is mashed.
Amateur neurobiologist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
I do it in my spare time.
Cool. Mashed. Yeah. Gravy?
Gravy is good, but if you want to put some like bacon, cheese, sour cream, sauce, like hot sauce.
So you're doing like baked potato style, except with mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
That's cool.
A good way. Brown butter is even better.
Brown butter. You gotta brown the butter. That's always the secret. Yeah. I learned that from Game of Thrones. Hi, I'm Dan. I live in Cleveland where it is just raining in the winter, which is my least favorite weather.
It's 70 degrees here.
Really?
70 and sunny. Yeah.
God, it was supposed to get warm yesterday and it never did. Oh. And now it just rained really hard all day. And there's my backyard. It's just a lake. It's just a nightmare. Anyway, I do web development and stuff. And my favorite way to eat potatoes, I don't know. I mean, I like lots of forms of potatoes. My least favorite way is like, I know this isn't the question, but I'm gonna say it anyway. Like, what is the they're like where it's like sliced in thin slices, and they're like there's a name for it.
Scalloped.
Yeah, scalloped potatoes. Hate that. I don't know why. Just don't like it. My most favorite. I don't know. I mean, like I like a fry. You know, like I like a good fry. I like a good tater tot. I like a
do
good
you
potato
have
pancakes.
Funeral really potatoes. Good.
I haven't been to a funeral for a long time, so I'm not sure.
I don't. It's like
no, I don't know what
cubed
is.
Potatoes, and I think it's baked with like mayonnaise and cheese and cornflakes on top.
Oh,
and it is delicious. Like it's probably trash for your body,
really
but it's very tasty.
I had a what is the au gratin? How do you say that?
Yeah.
I had a Emily and I went on a date a couple of weeks ago, and it was like one of the sides was potato au gratin, but it was like this like barrel. It was like, I don't know what it was like the size of like a medicine bottle kind of, you know, like I'm holding my hand up. I know the listeners can't see it, but perfectly shaped, and then like it had the, like the cheese and stuff inside, and it was yeah. It kind of sounds like that minus the, maybe the cereal, but it was really really good. Very fancy though. But yeah, I'm kind of a potato, you know. What is the word for somebody who likes just like all? I don't like
potato head.
I don't like I don't like seek out potato all the time, but like I rarely find a potato situation side dish that I don't like. You know what I mean?
I don't think I've ever found one.
Yeah, yeah. Unless they're undercooked, then that's no fun.
You can eat raw sweet potatoes, but not raw white potatoes.
You eat raw sweet potatoes?
You can. I have, yeah.
Like just like an apple?
Yeah, exactly. I just bite right into it. No, I don't do it like that.
Gross.
Shave it a little bit so it's thin, but it's crunchy.
Yeah, I think I've seen that. All right.
I don't eat it straight. I don't like eat a pile of like raw sweet potatoes.
Unwashed. Get that
mixed
dirt
it in a salad or something.
Oh, man. All right, Dominic, why don't you go ahead?
Okay, now. Yeah, so I'm Dominic. I'm from the United Kingdom. I currently work as a full stack developer at a main e-commerce focused web dev agency based in the UK, and I don't eat potatoes, so it's a very easy answer to the intro question. Although maybe once every few years I have a package of what we call crisps in the UK, but really only once few years.
Is there a reason you don't eat potatoes? You just don't like them, or you know?
Yeah, I think I just don't like them really. Yeah.
That's fair.
So yeah.
Huh. I would really like to not like potatoes because I just eat a lot of potatoes.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely a lot of spare calories coming through with potatoes. Mm-hmm. The ways you have to make them taste good.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't eat them straight though. It'll make you sick. Welcome, Dominic. It's really great to have you on the podcast this season. And we always like to start with your developer origin story. But before we jump into that, why don't you give us one word that describes your story?
Roller coaster.
All right. All right. Oh, yeah. Now tell us more about that.
Yeah. So I think I'm kind of taking it from that I feel like I've had both slow periods and then fast periods that have gone faster than I expected, really. So when I first started actually building my first website, I think I was about 15 or 16, and I was building a website for my mother, who's an artist, as a project sort of towards the end of my home education time, when it seemed like a good idea how we got online, and I was getting interested in the web development software Adobe Dreamweaver to do some kind of real project with it. And after that, I did that actually just using the graphical user interface, but you can click on a thing and you can see the code, which kind of got me interested in seeing the code and realized that sometimes you can actually do things quicker if you just tweak that rather than clicking on the buttons in the GUI. And from there, I started relatively slowly over a period of several years, learning a few bits more here and there of different coding stuff, dabbling in different things, most of which I didn't really continue with very much. So I made one or two projects, like I think I did a calculator in Java and then didn't really learn any more Java. I did some kind of very small project in Visual Basic, I think, but I can't even remember any of the syntax now. Then I got a bit sort of more proficient with the HTML, CSS, and JavaScript and built a few just personal fun projects. Started working on some collaborative projects from around 2019. Then there came a time when I thought, I didn't think I was ready to really like look for a job, but that it wouldn't do any harm to get some interview practice. And actually, the first interview I got led to a job. So
oh my gosh.
Kind of very fast. I'd been going very slowly for quite a long time, and suddenly it went very fast. And I think in the couple of years since then, I've learned a lot more than I ever have studying through tutorials or taking university courses. Some of the modules I've done at the Open University are computer science type ones, but I think like I've learned far more, far faster just by actually working on a job. and realize maybe at the same time that you don't actually have to be ready when you start your first job. You get the right one. And there was a very intense sort of first 3 to 6 months when I at many times felt like maybe I couldn't really do this. It was too much, but then I got through it and I got more confident. And yes, that's sort of been a high and fast period for the last couple of years or so.
I really like that idea that you talked about the first 3 to 6 months being like, I don't know if I can do this, because I think my experience was very similar. I'm like, I was not cut out to be doing this. I don't know what I'm doing or, yeah,
I think a lot of people actually go through that phase. I know at least one person who in their first job, in the first few weeks, actually went to their boss and said, I can't do this. I think I'm going to have to quit. And he told them, yes, you can do it. And they stayed on it. And I bet that's not the only person who's thought like that.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And I love that they were willing to have that conversation with their boss and their boss pushed back, because I think that there are probably plenty of people out there that are like, all right, fine, see you later. And then you just have lost out on that experience.
Yeah, sure. I didn't quite get to the point of having that conversation, but there were sometimes days when I was wondering during the first 3 months or so.
That's really great. And so you had maybe like a supportive structure. The people that hired you, you know, were ready for somebody who's it's still in the learning phase of things? Or
I think it was also probably helpful that in some way that I was in that relatively unusual position that I'd spent quite a lot of years doing aspects of it, but I didn't necessarily have the kind of level of experience that maybe knew how to do stuff, but I also knew what I was working with. I mean, I'd always been interested in trying to think of my own ideas for what to do. I never really liked following a tutorial project. I never made any of the classic tutorial projects like to-do lists and that sort of...
Yeah, you talked a little bit about...
better off. Sorry, Becca. Go ahead.
You talked a little bit about having some collaborative experiences while you were learning. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I think the highlight of that was working in a community group called Pass the Pen. And there was a few months when we were working on an escape room, which is still up on CodePen, I believe. Not certain everything still works. You know what it's like with web things, stuff can disappear. But how that worked was that quite a few people contributed puzzles which would be solved, and then three of us, me, one other person, and the organizer, were then working together to incorporate all these puzzles into the one escape room game, which is a surprisingly complicated experience when you have, these things did not necessarily work together. They were all different styles. We had to try and make something coherent out of this. And that was quite interesting. I think we did a reasonably good job. And it was interesting and useful, I think, to get the experience of working together with two other people on a real project where there were things that had been decided that affected what we had to do and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's so cool. So did you just find that randomly, Google
search? I got involved in that community early on in its inception through people I met on Twitter.
Yeah.
And it has been very much paused, I think, in the last couple of years. Theoretically, maybe stuff will be done in the future. I don't know.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. And it sounds like you've done a lot of really cool things through the connections that you've made online. And one of those things that I was hoping we could talk about is Art Tech Chat, which I'll let you explain it. So go ahead and introduce it and talk a little bit about that.
I have been co-organizing for several years now. It is a Twitter chat covering topics in art, design, and technology every Sunday. We do a different topic each week. We post questions, people answer. And we retweet is basically the former. I think that we've had a lot of interesting conversations with quite a variety of people. it's possibly not been as like busy as some other Twitter chats, but I think we've also covered some quite niche crossover topics that has led to very interesting conversations among small groups of people.
I really love the questions that you ask. I try and catch it async. Sundays are just, I'm not on a schedule on Sundays, so I just like usually forget about everything that happens. But the questions that you ask are not ones that we commonly see in tech. And I think that's really great because you hear a lot of people talking about the same things all the time. So even sometimes I don't answer, but I read the questions and I sit there and I like think about it for a long time. And like, what does that mean? And how do I understand that thing? And so, you know, at the very least, like I appreciate the ability to think deeper about these topics that are not always on my radar. How did you get started with Art Tech Chat? How did you decide to start it?
So I came up with the idea one day, and I decided to suggest it to Ali Bittel, who I had met through the Code Newbie Twitter chats, and within about a couple of weeks we got it started. After a few months she had quite a lot of other things happening in her life and bowed out, so I brought on board someone who'd been regularly participating, Shannon Crable, with whom I've been co-organizing it ever since. And yeah, it was one of these things where I just came up with the idea and actually decided to do it.
I love that. That's awesome. I think sometimes we overthink the things that we're doing and then we don't ever get them started, or then we start them, but 2 years after that, we initially had the idea and they're like, why didn't I do it then?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, I have plenty of ideas that haven't ever gone anywhere. So. Yeah. Better than you thought of, though. You'd never have time to do everything.
Right. Never been in that situation before.
I was just like I paused. Hey, that's my life. See my face. I was like, wait a minute. I'm thinking of all the things that I haven't done yet. Like, what should I be doing right now?
What made you like want to lean into like the art, you know, tech crossover? You know, you see most of the Twitter chats that I see, and I'm obviously, my Twitter feed is mostly tech people, you know, so it's a lot of, you know, just tech stuff, right? Or JavaScript or CSS or whatever. But I really like that. I really like the concept of, you know, of leaning on the art side of it, because I think it gets lost a lot of times. Can you speak a little bit about like just why, what made, you know, what drew you to combining the two and trying to get a community going around that?
Yeah, I suppose it probably comes from my background growing up with my mother, who's an artist, and going to art events with her, which gave me some kind of insights into the art world as well. And I'd done quite a bit of small scale creative coding and things in my earlier coding days, and followed quite a few people in Twitter who did that sort of thing. So I suppose it just seemed like a sort of natural idea for an area to look at doing things.
Yeah, that's so cool. I mean, I appreciate that. I lived in the creative arts house in college, right? It was like a on-campus housing. And I always loved the combination, you know, when you combine art with different mediums and different things. And that's one of the reasons I've always kind of appreciated the Art Tech Chat, you know, experience that you put together, that you work on. It's really cool. It's really cool stuff.
I want to maybe jump back in time, if that's okay. And I know that your education wouldn't be considered traditional. Can we talk a little bit about your home education experience and how that you think that might have impacted your journey?
Yeah, so I think it allowed me to go further faster on the areas that interested me without having to waste time on things that if I'd been in school I would have had to do and then would never have done anything with afterwards. And so I think that was probably helpful. But also, I think it gives you that sort of thinking outside the box type of approach to things. And I feel that probably I wouldn't necessarily have come up with some of the same ideas if I hadn't had that start.
Yeah, I think the idea that's really fascinating for me right now, I have 4 kids, and my 13-year-old, we decided to home educate this semester. And I was talking to him yesterday in the car. And I'm like, okay, well, what are the things you don't like? What are the things that you do like about it? And one of it was what you're talking about, to be able to pursue the things that you're interested in and not waste time on other things or having to deal with, you know, staying focused in a period of time where you can't stay focused. And one of the things that I think is really great about different forms of education is that usually when you go to, I don't know, a regular school, I'm not really sure how else to say it, right? Like traditional education, when you use a traditional education method, you are taught to think in certain ways. And when we're all taught to think in certain ways, then it does become much harder to think outside of the box. And that's exactly what you're talking about. When you have the room to grow in a way that works for you, then you're going to maybe approach things differently or be able to see things that other people don't. And I think that's a really great strength to develop in any industry, but especially in the tech industry.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that it brings different perspectives that can push innovation forward. And I kind of feel that I've noticed that there seems to be a greater number of people in and around tech who come from non-traditional educational backgrounds than I found in other fields where I have awareness of. And I wonder whether there is something about non-traditional education backgrounds develops a kind of mindset that works well in what the tech industry is doing. It's only a theory, but I think it might be like that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. And, you know, the thinking outside of the box stuff that you guys were talking about and is absolutely one of it, you know, and I think another piece of it is self-driven learning, right? Which I think is one of the most important things, important skills or, I don't know, attributes or whatever of a developer, at least, is the like ability and willingness and almost maybe excitedness about being able to like find something and learn something new on your own, you know, right? And find a problem, you know, see a problem and say, okay, well, there's got to be a good way to solve this, you know, and go and find it on your own and then do it, right? Yeah. That sort of self-activating, you know, learning process is such an important thing for developers to have. And I think my assumption is a lot of non-traditional education paths will kind of instill that naturally without, you know, without like, today we're going to work on self-driven learning, right? That's wow, like, not, you know, not like a lesson plan, you know what I mean? But because, just, yeah.
Saying today we're going to work on this is the opposite.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And I think also like the tech industry and development and things is one of these things where you're not going to spend 3 or 4 years at a university and learn everything you need to learn, and then you're just going to use that to do whatever job you do afterwards. It doesn't work like that. There's always going to be something new to learn, and a lot of the time you're going to have to do it on your own because of something that you need to do.
If
you don't know how to do that, that is going to be a disadvantage.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's, I think, the other piece of why lots of times the tech industry or the programming industry or whatever will collect people from things like this, you know, non-traditional learning paths, neurodiverse people, I think, is that there's not really a clear path to become a web developer in a traditional model. There's like, there probably are web development degrees somewhere at a university that you could get. I'm not sure, but like, it's very much still a thing that almost everybody picks up on their own. And then they maybe some people do a boot camp for a little bit or do, you know, other things, but they're starting to become a little bit more structured, but they're all still like a boot camp is still a non-traditional way to learn a thing, you know? And it's maybe becoming traditional in our field, but not in the world, you know? And so people that come to this are oftentimes people that are not following a traditional path in their lives, you know, whether that's right out of high school or, you know, right out of, you know, becoming 18 or whatever, or right out of, or career, you know, changing their career to something else later in life or anything. It's one of the things I love about the tech industry. So it's cool to hear you talk about it.
Yeah. And I think too, as part of that, it is valuable to know how to code and how to do the technical things, but it's valuable to bring different insight into what you're doing, because ultimately most of us are building things for non-technical people. And to have some sense or understanding of what that looks like in different aspects of the world helps to inform what we build, how we build it, and making good user experiences for other people. I think another part of this, a different approach to education, is being able to learn the value of things that challenge us. And I think that you can do that, and that idea of like self-exploration. Yeah, some people might just choose the easiest things out there, but when you find something that you're interested in, I think you're more likely to tackle things that challenge you, whether that's in your opinions or your capabilities to work on a project. Have you found that you dove into some things that you found challenging and got that reward?
Yes, I think I did tend to go quite deeply into the things that I was actually going to do. I remember when I had a tutor for mathematics in the run-up to examinations, I took in that at the school leaving age, that she would often comment that I seemed to actually like what she called the horrible questions in work that she would set from the books. And yes, I wouldn't necessarily just like try and do all the easy ones. I actually relished the challenge of the hard questions, because I'd actually decided that mathematics was one of the subjects I wanted to study. And yeah, I think I generally did like going in. I mean, I also remember quite a younger age, my grandfather bought some school curriculum books, and initially the idea was I would have the ones appropriate to my age, but I found those quite boring in the subject I was interested in. We straight onto the ones for 14 to 16-year-old. So I was reading the material for people who take those exams several years before I actually took them.
I have a brother that's 2 years older than I am, and I'm slightly competitive, but I
slightly.
Anytime he brought home a book from school, I would read that book just because I'm like, see, I can do it. I'm gonna read this book, and it's even harder than that one. So I also find that being motivated by more challenging things can be really helpful in the learning experience.
Yeah, it's a good way to stay interested too, right? My experience, yeah, there's something like that can be kind of satisfying to like knocking down all the easy answers really quick, you know. But those ones where you really have to dig in, obviously, if you're interested in it, become much more satisfying ultimately. I recently have been on a Sudoku journey again, and have been actually pushing myself to get further down into the harder ones. In my little Sudoku app, I'm in the pro section now. So,
watch out.
Blast a pass expert, you know.
Next thing you know, you're going to be introducing yourself at the beginning of the podcast as Dan from Cleveland, Sudoku expert.
Professional Sudoku player. It says pro in the app, so I'm pretty sure that means there's somewhere I can get sponsored. You know, I can start wearing like a NASCAR jacket, you know, except with Sudoku sponsors, you know. It's going to be
also
really good.
If anyone's listening that sponsors Sudoku pros, you can also sponsor the podcast. So,
oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sorry, Dominic. I will blame Dan.
Hey.
Another one of the things that I'd love to talk about is your contributions to open source. So you've done a lot of volunteering for Virtual Coffee, and you put together some great resources and documentation for people who are involved in open source. So can you talk a little bit about that journey too?
Yes. I mean, I spent probably 2 or 3 years before I started looking at employment. I was looking at kind of contributing to open source. Initially, I find it quite challenging to get into it because there seemed to be quite a lot of stuff you had to learn how to do around process and things, which when you're coming in from not having ever contributed to a project, it can all be quite overwhelming and confusing. So it wasn't really until the Virtual Coffee Hacktoberfest initiative that I really started to make any kind of serious contribution. And I think it's having that kind of group of people who can guide you into things is very, very helpful for getting started. And since then, I have tried to keep up making contributions. I've contributed to some good projects, I think. Probably the highlights would be, so was the work I did in Elm with Kirk on the Quarterer. I think that was that first year. And then work I'd done on your postpartum wellness app, Becca, which in React Native kind of seems to be a good fit for being slightly different from what I do day to day, but also similar enough that I that the skills are transferable. Yeah, I think contributing to open source is very helpful for learning and building confidence. And it gives you actually the ability to get exposure to how development is really done. Whereas a lot of educational pathways, you might learn how to write code, but you don't learn how to actually be a developer and the processes that writing code is done within. And open source contributions are one of the ways in which you can get exposure to that without actually having a full-time job.
Yeah, I said that a couple of times on the podcast. I went to boot camp, it was self-paced, and I didn't have that opportunity to interact with other people and code and to dive into code bases that were larger than the projects that I was working on. And so if you do contribute to open source and you're learning, I think it's valuable to contribute to open source throughout your career, but especially if you're learning and you want to get a sense of what it's like to be on a team, that's a really great process to familiarize yourself with and to grow in that way. And like, I've appreciated all your contributions, and I know that, you know, I know some stuff about React Native. It's always a learning process for the project, and you know, to be able to work through that with you and the other contributors has been really a really great learning experience for me as a maintainer, because I also feel comfortable having the conversation and sometimes saying like, hey, Dominic, I have no idea what I'm doing here. So maybe we can talk through this thing together. And, you know, it's helped me to kind of develop this project that's I'm very interested in seeing through.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the one biggest thing that open source forces you to do is to get comfortable with Git, a thing that's often not really taught.
Sometimes I just delete entire repos to not deal with any of those problems.
Right, yeah, which you can do when you're working on your own project.
Yep, not when you're working.
You can't do it, though. Yeah.
Would not recommend doing that on somebody else's project.
Yeah,
but it is really helpful. And then having people at Virtual Coffee there to walk me through some of the times that I've made a mess of things has been super helpful as well, because I think that, you know, there's always the tendency to think that you have to figure out everything yourself, and you don't. There's plenty of people out there that are willing to help. You just have to ask for it.
I was so I have like this question that I've been trying to formulate in my head. I don't really have it all the way worked out, but one thing that is recurring over your career, your portfolio, all this stuff is like this idea of connection, right? You have the art tech spaces, you have the I see you've done some community things on Inter Intellect, which is cool. And maybe I'll ask you about that a little bit later. But and also, like, for listeners that I'm not sure if we mentioned this, but Dominic's been running our Virtual Coffee Twitter chats as well, right? And a lot of reaching out. And you were when you were talking about your coding journey, you had that that CodePen, you know, little thing that you worked on. And I guess my question is like, not having gone through the homeschooling experience myself, right? It always, like, one of the downsides, and I have kids, you know, and you always think about all sorts of different possibilities for your kids, you know, right? And one of the, like, potential downsides that I see is the loss of connection, right? You're in your house just with you and your parents or whoever is the one that is, you know, homeschooling you. And sometimes, obviously, there's millions of different situations, right? But that seems like one of the one of the things that might be, maybe somebody would miss versus a traditional schooling where you're kind of in a classroom with other kids all the time. And I've just noticing this connection with you, with your work, where a lot of your efforts are around connecting with other people, and it's really cool. And I was just wondering, and if this doesn't make sense at all, you could just say, sorry, Dan, I don't understand what you're saying. But if there's something like between your upbringing, you know, and your experience with homeschooling and your current comfort and effort to connect with people online, you know, in different spaces.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether there is a connection or not, but one thing I think that the homeschooling does do is it actually gives you a broader range of experiences of connecting with people growing up. Because if you go to school every day, you might have a greater number of connections and time spent connecting and socializing with people, but with a very narrow peer group of people who are all your age and thinking and doing very similar things.
Sure.
Whereas when, like in the homeschooling model, and you typically don't just stay at home every day.
No, I sort of assumed out, not. But
kind of get this experience where you spend time out in the real world and you talk to and connect with people of all different ages instead of that narrow group. So you might get a lower volume, but you get a higher range of it. And so I think that actually then creates a sort of more of a natural ability to connect with a wider range of people in a broader range of situations, that you're not molded into this idea that you connect with your peer group of people who are very similar to you.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And you know, this is just making me think about it, right? This isn't something I've thought of before, but along with that, this maybe goes back to or connects with a lot of the like self-directing learning stuff that we were talking about as well. When you're describing what you were just describing, it seems like more of an active connection, right? As opposed to when you go to school, traditional school, it's a passive thing, right? I mean, it's like you're in the classroom, you know, I mean, some people handle that different ways, but it's like, you don't have a choice. You're there. Right. And when in that homeschooling model, it's much more sort of active and intentional, right? Intentional connections. And so maybe that's part of it. Maybe you're just sort of naturally get better at or you know, make that more of a natural process, you know, as opposed to just sitting around and hoping somebody will be in your classroom or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, I tended to have very little interest in other children. We used to go to meet-up events where home-educating families in the area got together, but I always preferred to sit at the table where all the parents were rather than do things with children. I don't know if the parents liked that quite as much as I did, because I sometimes would like to be involved in the conversation. They might have preferred me not to be, I don't know. But, yeah.
Yeah, you know, really I'm reading this book, or I'm listening to this book right now. I think somebody at Virtual Coffee recommended it, Reclaiming Conversation. And it's been really fascinating and challenged a lot of my own thinking. And part of the book that I'm on anyway is talking about how our kids are losing, I don't think she uses the word emotional intelligence, but that's what it sounds like, and the ability to have conversations. And part of that is because they're communicating differently. And this is like, please, this is a simplified version of what she's saying, right? She's taking a whole book. Part of that is they're not having face-to-face conversations with people, but part of that is also they're not hearing other adults have conversations either, because it's not just that kids have their faces looking at devices all day, but adults do as well. And there's value in being able to have conversations with other people of different age groups and backgrounds. And we had a lot of that before with our children, parents and their children, but it's happening less and less. And it's impacting the emotional intelligence of the current generation that's growing up. And I think that what you're talking about, Dominic, says a lot about developing the emotional intelligence, developing core skills to be able to communicate with a wide variety of other people. And I imagine gaining empathy, because when you're in a classroom, like you're saying, you're talking to a group of students that is very similar in all of the things that they're doing, right? It's very, this is where they're at. This is the level that they're at. And in the same way that you might want to pursue, like my son, he's really interested in, yesterday for English class, he listened to a Brandon Sanderson world building video, right? He's not going to get that in eighth grade. Or maybe probably ever, but it's probably like higher level thinking. And so he's pursuing something that is at a much higher level than what he would get at school. And in the same way, when we have conversations, we can pursue our interests with people who are at a higher level in thinking those things through as well. And so my tangent wrapping it up here is that we have it. Having the ability to have conversations with people in different backgrounds, different age levels, probably goes a long way to developing your communication skills that benefit you throughout whatever career or industry you're in.
Yeah, I think another thing is the sort of random conversations you can end up getting into out and about. And often, when people hear that you are doing a non-traditional education, they actually get quite interested and will talk about the things they do in their lives. I remember we used to travel a lot on buses, and I remember we would sometimes do things like quizzes out loud, and there were some passengers nearby one day who said they would ask us a question, and we kind of got talking about things, and I learned some like really quite obscure facts about cedar trees and their qualities relating to moss. Just the kind of random conversation you suddenly have with someone who knows something about a topic that you didn't know about, and you would probably never have actually got talking to them if you hadn't been doing something maybe slightly non-traditional.
I love that. I love that idea of just those random connections and how, you know, how that non-traditional stuff, you know, it can just foster all of that stuff. It's so good. I don't know.
Yeah. I think another thing that is
my life choice. Well, yeah.
Not having a car actually also helps you to build up, you actually get talking to people when you have to use public transport. And you can sometimes be thought of as being a bit disadvantaged if you don't have a car. But sometimes I also wonder whether actually it's no disadvantage in always being inside your own metal walls with four wheels.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lot of places in America, it's very hard to do that, you know, but yeah, but you're right. And you know, that connection, you know, and those just sort of happenstance things that can happen. Of course, there could be some bad things that can happen to you sometimes.
Yeah.
Non-pleasant conversations on the bus. I've experienced a few of those.
But yeah. It's happened to me. Yeah.
But those are part of the learning journey too, right?
But honestly, it is. And that's like part of the book too. She's talking about we don't have hard conversations, and oftentimes we default to having most of our conversations in written text because we have more control over them, but that inhibits our ability to communicate in hard subjects, but also to recognize how we're feeling about those subjects ourselves. And so even really terrible conversations that you have, although, you know, maybe you wish that you didn't have to have them, it is a learning experience in how to communicate with other people and how to navigate those particular situations. So I think that idea of, also, like, I'm terrified of talking to strangers. So I've done a lot more in the last year. I've done a fair amount of traveling, and out of necessity at airports, sometimes I just don't hear what they're calling over the PA system. And so I have to ask somebody. And oftentimes that leads to a conversation with that person that I would not have had otherwise. And so I do appreciate having those conversations and taking each experience as a learning experience. And I think that in a lot of ways, kind of that whole reframing the education experience is something that you take with you your entire life. And, you know, if you have had a bad experience, maybe It's okay to sit in those emotions where you're not feeling great about it, but then thinking about like, okay, what have I learned from this and how can I take this moving forward, can help us navigate some of those, you know, challenges that we're going to have in the future.
Yes, I think that makes sense. Yeah.
And so, you know, with all of these different learning communities, you have Art Tech Chat, Virtual Coffee, and Intellect. How do you think that being involved in these different communities has given you different opportunities of maybe thinking through things or learning?
Yeah, I think it's been very important. And I don't think if I hadn't been found communities online and been part of those, that I would actually have thought in terms of doing things like applying for jobs at the time I did and that kind of thing. And I think I would very probably not have had the experience or the things to put on the resume that made me seem attractive to someone either. So I think it has been very important. And I think that there's a lot of things I wouldn't have learned without it.
Yeah, it really gives an opportunity to dive into, you know, maybe ideas that you wouldn't have had otherwise, which is great because you don't want to live in an echo chamber because that's, although it might feel safe and comfortable, you're not growing in that situation.
No. And I think also, like, when you're learning, you're often, a lot of times when you're learning to code, you might just be doing your own projects on your own, but actually a large part of the work of being a developer is communicating with people to make sure you're writing the right code, because you could write very good code, but it might not be doing the right thing, in which case it's not actually very useful. And you have to learn that by actually working with people.
Yeah, that's great.
Totally.
Well, Dominic, it's been really great chatting with you, and we have just a little bit of time left to wrap things up. So if you could describe yourself in one word, what would it be?
Polymathic.
All right. Now tell us a little bit about what that is.
it comes from the word polymath, which is about like when you're kind of you do multiple things, which I kind of see myself in that way, that I would not just focus on one thing, that I have many different interests, and I'm interested in trying to develop a situation where I can pursue different strands of things where they relate to one another, and that in a sense fits into quite all the different things I do, and looking at crossovers between different subject matters. I think also, I mean, to go back to the Intellect and the salons I have hosted there, which are typically on tech adjacent subjects, looking at tech and other disciplines related to other interests I have around economics and governance and collections and that kind of thing.
That's awesome. I really love that word. Thanks so much, Dominic, for being here with us and sharing your journey. This was really, really fascinating.
Yeah, thank you, Dominic. It's great to have you on. It had been too long, so I'm very glad to have you here. All right, well, we will talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Virtual Coffee Podcast. This episode was produced by Dan Ott and Becca Harat-Weigel. If you have questions or comments, you can hit us up on Twitter at virtualcoffee.io or email us at podcast@virtualcoffee.io. You can find the show notes, sign up for the newsletter, check out any of our other resources on our website, virtualcoffee.io. If you're interested in sponsoring Virtual Coffee, you can find out more information on our website at virtualcoffee.io/sponsorship. Please subscribe to our podcast and be sure to leave us a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.